Well, first, thanks very much to Sebastian and for the invitation, for all of you for coming out today. If I stand here, am I blocking the view of the images? Or are you fine? Okay, great. Meryl Streep walks into a bar. She appears flustered. She exhales loudly and then exclaims, "I need a drink. I need a drink, please." The bartender, played by Kevin Costner, grabs a can of beer, pours it into a glass, and asks, "You're okay?" "No, I'm not okay," she says. "I couldn't stand it out there. I hate thinking about this stuff. What if we've screwed it up so bad that they can't fix it? I mean, it's crazy what we're doing." Streep has just come from an Earth Day 1990 rally in which speaker after speaker has bemoaned the severity of the global environmental crisis. Costner agrees with his anxious customer that the situation is really bad, even terrifying. She chides him, "I thought bartenders are supposed to make you feel better." "I can do that," Costner says. And then he describes everyday actions, especially recycling, that individuals can take to demonstrate their environmental concern. When Streep questions whether these tiny and pathetic gestures can ward off the looming global environmental crisis, he deflects her pessimism by emphasizing the therapeutic value of recycling. "You need to do something," he says, "instead of being afraid. You do something, you're gonna start to feel better about yourself." So he hands her the can of beer, and he points to a recycling bin, which is behind the bar. As she prepares to aim and shoot, he advises, "Take your time, don't rush this. This could change your life." This fictional barroom exchange occurs near the end of the Earth Day special, which is a star-studded TV program that ABC aired during prime time on April 22, 1990, which was the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. Hailed as the largest gathering of entertainers ever to appear on a single TV program, the Earth Day special provides us with a particularly illuminating and revealing example of how the mass media embraced the environmental cause. So in this show, you see Bette Midler starring as an ailing Mother Earth. She's suffering from pollution and other environmental problems. Now, if you are at all familiar with American television from the 1980s, you would find this show to be, you know, particularly an amazingly rich example of the ways in which mass media and environmentalism intersect with one another. Just to give you a few examples of what happened on this show, Neil Patrick Harris, who was the star of Doogie Howser, M.D., which was a show about a teenage doctor, he plays in this show, once again, as a teenage doctor, but here he's trying to revive Mother Earth. The entire cast of some of the most popular TV shows of the 80s, Cheers, The Cosby Show, The Golden Girls, and on and on and on, all appear in this show and demonstrate how they are concerned about the environment and want to take action to protect the Earth against all of these horrific environmental problems. And at a very crucial moment in the show, the adorable alien E.T. shows up, and he gives the Earthlings a much-needed manual that tells them how they can save the planet. Now, I know when I describe this to you, this sounds perhaps rather ridiculous and absurd, and would make an easy target for ridicule. The notion of Bette Midler starring as Mother Earth, or E.T. giving ecological wisdom to human beings, would seem like an easy target for ridicule. But what I want to suggest is that what makes this show so telling is how it merged so seamlessly with the broader media extravaganza of Earth Day 1990. If you look at a wide variety of visual and cultural fields from this time, spectators were repeatedly urged to seek both personal therapy and a sense of political empowerment through individual action. The paper that I'm presenting today is derived from my forthcoming book, Seeing Green, The Use and Abuse of American Environmental Images, which will be published early next year. The book looks at a wide array of media images, pictures in popular magazines, television news, advertisements, cartoons, films, and political posters, to show how dominant ideas of environmentalism became naturalized through repetition. The book ranges from fears of radioactive fallout and pesticides during the Cold War through contemporary concerns about global warming. And it focuses on key moments in which media images both provoked environmental anxiety, but also prescribed limited forms of action. The book argues that media images have made the environmental crisis visible to a mass public, but have also masked systemic causes and ignored structural inequalities. Deflecting attention from corporate and government responsibility, popular images have instead emphasized the idea that individuals are personally culpable for environmental problems. So the media have offered environmentalists a double-edged sword. They've helped them popularize their cause, but also distorted their ideas by portraying their movement as a moralistic crusade to absolve the nation of its guilt. This dual focus on spectacles of crisis and individual consumer choices has hidden underlying causes and structural solutions behind a veil of inattention. So this paper will focus on one part of the book, which is the period in the late 80s and early 90s, in which we see how the notion of a long-term global environmental crisis becomes fused with a short-term focus on individual privatized action. Now, these two themes that I'm putting together, planetary peril and individual responsibility, have long played an important role in environmentalism. So if we look back to the period surrounding the first Earth Day in 1970, you see images such as Earthrise from 1968 and other Earth images would be used by activists to explain their concern about a worsening environmental crisis. Likewise, at that time, there were popular environmental handbooks that would talk about individual actions people could take, including recycling, which was a countercultural practice in the 60s and 70s. And we see the logo, the recycling logo, emerge soon after the first Earth Day and later become an icon of sustainability. So these themes of the personal and the global were very much a part of the first Earth Day in 1970, but I argue that they become much more tightly linked 20 years later around the time of Earth Day 1990. So the individual and the global, the personal and the planetary become more linked during this period than ever before. So what I'll do in this paper is try to explain to you how environmental anxiety becomes simultaneously globalized and personalized during this period. And I'll argue that the period around Earth Day 1990 constitutes not only a pivotal moment in the history of environmentalism, but a pivotal phase in what I call the emotional history of capitalism. Capitalism and emotion become enmeshed in new and complicated ways during this period. We see corporations sometimes seeming responsible for the environmental crisis, but at the same time, the market, spurred on by enlightened consumers, also seems to offer the most promising path out of this abyss. So in an age when market metaphors become increasingly dominant in the United States and public life in America, faith in personal responsibility and market-based solutions also take center stage in media framings of environmentalism. So popular visual imagery reveals the environmental effects of consumer culture, but the coverage ultimately moves toward visions of individual hope and consumer-induced change. In this neoliberal age, media packaging of environmental hope frames the movement itself as a form of therapy, a way for individuals to cope with the distressing imagery of environmental crisis. So I'm going to begin today by looking at how images popularize environmental anxiety, and in so doing, challenge free market fundamentalism that becomes dominant in this period, represented by Ronald Reagan and other conservative politicians. I'll move rather quickly through a few image examples here, including the danger of Alar-laced apples, the garbage crisis, and signs of global collapse. And this will show how images help temper free market ideology. Then I'll move into discussion of how the therapeutic mode becomes predominant. And I'll show how these images connect to larger national and global context, including the end of the Cold War, the triumph of neoliberal values, and the popular expansion of recycling during this period. And ultimately, what I want to do to you today is suggest that the barroom conversation between Streep and Costner captures the emotional dynamics and the delimited scope of environmentalism during the period surrounding Earth Day 1990. So throughout the 1980s, and especially during the latter part of the decade, we see environmental spectacle pushing back against free market fundamentalism. The visual media publicize a series of environmental crises that signify inherent ecological limits rather than Reaganite dreams of boundlessness. These images help mass audiences see the ecological consequences of consumer culture and thus mobilize feelings of environmental anxiety. A key example here is from 1987. This is the Mobro garbage barge, which set sail from Long Island, New York in 1987, looking for a place to dump over 3,000 tons of trash. The Mobro journey down the Atlantic Ocean all the way over to the Gulf of Mexico, only to be rejected by six different states and three foreign countries, and it eventually returned to New York 2 months later. TV news broadcasts provided viewers with regular updates of this garbage barge, which became, according to one news account, the most watched load of garbage in the memory of man. The New Yorker offered this great cartoon about the absurdity of the voyage. We see two rats that are standing in front of the towering bales of trash, and one of them says to the other, "In your wildest dreams, did you ever think you'd one day be cruising the Gulf of Mexico?" Media coverage framed the garbage barge as a harbinger of things to come, a sign of the looming landfill crisis and the need to promote recycling. So the Mobro gives a sign of the wastefulness of consumer culture, but the Alar scare publicized the risk to fragile, vulnerable ecological bodies, and particularly mobilized parental anxiety about the threats to children. So in 1989, Meryl Streep, a year before she's worried about what to do with her beer can, becomes a spokesperson for a campaign warning about the effects of pesticides, and in particular, the danger of Alar that's been applied to apples, and how these chemicals can affect the young, how children are particularly vulnerable to environmental risk. But the demise of Alar came not because of government action, but because of its manufacturer deciding, due to consumer concerns about the risk to children, to pull the product from the market. So if American consumers seem to be victims of the environmental crisis, they also appeared, in this case, to be agents of change, using their purchasing power to alter corporate policy. So over and over again following this episode, the news media, along with many environmentalists, would begin to say that consumers could create a healthier, more sustainable environment. One commentator would gush at the time, "It's consumer power that will change the world." Meanwhile, the media also gave increasing attention to a global sense of crisis. So there would be a macro view of planetary peril that would become very common during this time. Problems such as ozone depletion, global warming, rainforest destruction, all somehow seemed to be transnational and interconnected. So by the late 80s, you start to see all of these problems merging together to give a sense of an all-encompassing vision of global ecological danger. In January of 89, Time magazine, which always publishes a Man of the Year issue, broke from this tradition and instead put the endangered Earth on its cover, describing it as the planet of the year. Time asked the artist Christo, who was widely known and renowned and reviled in some cases for his public art projects and his large-scale earthworks, to represent a sense of global crisis. And what Christo decided to do was to take a small globe, to wrap it in plastic, bind it in rope, and then photograph the globe on top of a beach at sunrise. This piece is titled Wrapped Globe, and it references popular Earth imagery, such as Earthrise and Blue Marble, to try to connote a sense of fragility and vulnerability of life on this planet. But unlike these documentary images of the Earth taken by NASA, Wrapped Globe calls attention to its artifice. Rather than a shining blue ball that inspires awe in spectators, the plastic wrap bundled up globe appears as a synthetically produced icon, an item confined by human society. Throughout the issue, Time presented other images that tried to suggest a sense of global crisis. There will be pictures of rainforests burning in Brazil, the ozone over Antarctica, the ozone hole, cracked earth in the Great Plains, the Mobro returning to New York, all which signified an overarching sense of crisis, portents of planetary disaster. This macro perspective would appear in other images, including the official logo of Earth Day 1990. According to the designer of this logo, the iconic whole Earth photograph he thought was inadequate to represent a truly global vision. What he wanted to do here is to put all the countries of the Earth, to squeeze them into the same pictorial space. He called this his Last Supper solution. So just like you see all the people sitting on one side of the table in the Last Supper, he wanted to put all the nations of the Earth together on one side to squeeze them into this representation of international environmental concern. So this is the macro perspective that becomes dominant in this time, but it would also be joined by a micro perspective, an emphasis upon the individual consumer as the crucial lever of change. And in some cases, producers of environmental images consciously recognized and promoted the therapeutic action that came from recycling, the therapeutic value of individual action. So look at this recycling campaign that was developed by the Ad Council. This is the preeminent public service advertising firm in the United States. They created Smokey Bear, the Crying Indian, and other such popular emblems. This is done in conjunction with a mainstream environmental group, the Environmental Defense Fund, and in a series of TV spots and print ads that circulated in the late 80s and early 90s, they used the iconic photograph of the whole Earth to talk about the global meanings of individual action. If you're not recycling, the text says, you're throwing it all away. This campaign emerged as a direct response to anxieties triggered by the Mobro garbage barge in the late 80s. It used to be, the Ad Council said, that we rarely gave a thought to our trash after we placed it at the curb to be picked up and taken away. Now, like the sequels of a popular horror movie, our discarded waste keeps returning to haunt us. To assuage this anxiety, the campaign presented recycling as an everyday form of green therapy. According to the Ad Council, the campaign would target spectators who feel, quote, daunted by the apparent size and complexity of environmental problems. And it would combat this overwhelming feeling by offering people the knowledge that they can individually have a positive impact on the environment. Audiences would learn that recycling is, quote, emotionally rewarding because it's the most direct way that they can contribute to the protection of the environment. Now, cultural historians have given a lot of attention to the idea of the therapeutic mode of consumer culture. And most of their arguments suggest that therapy provides emotional fulfillment by devaluing public life. Recycling presents us with an interesting case because it would be celebrated for its supposed power to fuse the personal with the political and the planetary. So rather than just elevating personal gratification over the public good, recycling would be seen as a way for consumers to merge an inner-directed sense of well-being with an outward-looking concern about the environmental crisis. So the question becomes, why did this mode of environmentalism become so dominant during this period? Why did environmentalism come to be seen as an individualized therapeutic response to to global crisis. I want to emphasize three reasons. First, the end of the Cold War, together with the success of the ALAR campaign and other green consumerist projects, all reinforced increasing popular faith in the capitalist market as a key instrument of democracy. And it's helpful, I think, here to widen our view, to look at these kinds of environmental images in relation to other news media images of the time. And in particular, the post-Cold War frame performed really important ideological work in this context. So the events of the period surrounding Earth Day 1990 would not only lead to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but would also reveal haunting visual evidence of extensive environmental damage throughout Eastern Europe. Here we see a photograph of Copsa Mica, Romania, which Time magazine would describe as the blackest town in the world. Images of this polluted landscape would circulate widely in the period immediately before and after Earth Day 1990. And for many American viewers, at least, the imagery confirmed the inherent superiority of US capitalist democracy. And it contributed to a widespread belief in what Francis Fukuyama would exuberantly describe as the end of history. Meanwhile, while the fall of the Berlin Wall and the iconic image of the lone Chinese protester in Tiananmen Square would galvanize popular hope in the capacity of individuals to change the world. Like this photograph at Tiananmen Square, Earth Day 1990 would zero in on the individual as the agent of change. So the end of the Cold War is a major factor. Secondly, I argue that the visual politics of Earth Day 1990 oscillate between the personal and the global to create what we can consider to be a neoliberal politics of scale. So at the macro level, the environmental crisis seems both worldwide and potentially apocalyptic. And many images would give us this global vision of environmental crisis. These images, though, obscure power relations between different human communities. By trying to place all the nations of the world at the same side of the table, the image ignores the structural inequities within the global system. This is a time period when the United States is increasingly exporting toxic waste to the developing world. But these images give a sense of a global sense of vulnerability of all inhabiting the same space, an equally shared geography of risk. This global sense of crisis would be joined by a relentless focus on the micro, on the individual as the enlightened consumer who can redirect markets and create sustainability. So neoliberal models of citizenship mediate this apparent contradiction between the planetary and the personal. The neoliberal emphasis upon individual responsibility imagines environmental citizens governing at a distance, saving the earth by demonstrating ecological concern in the private realm. And finally, the rise of recycling programs provided a tangible way for individuals to gain a sense of involvement in the environmental cause. It's not coincidental that recycling, above all other actions, became the most prescribed form of environmental citizenship during this period. As I mentioned before, modern recycling had emerged as a countercultural practice in the 60s and 70s, and it only becomes mainstream during the period around Earth Day 1990. And this is because beverage and packaging companies, together with governments, tout it as the panacea to solve the nation's solid waste crisis. The recycling logo suddenly becomes ubiquitous, appearing on bins and beverage containers to become an emblem of sustainability. It would also be reworked by the plastic industry during this time. They started putting numbers inside the loop to suggest a sense of ecological harmony created through the process of recycling. So Meryl Streep, you remember she was about to toss her can into the beer can, into the recycling bin. She aims and shoots, and she makes it in there. Kevin Costner says to her, "Do you feel better?" "I do," she says, and then she adds with a flirtatious giggle, "But I'm not sure it has anything to do with the environmental movement." Rather than continuing in this banter, they don't end up going out on a date or anything like that. They instead offer a solemn recognition of how they need to act as proper environmental citizens. Now, just as Kevin Costner tried to make Meryl Streep feel better by showing her where to toss her beer can, the media spectacle of Earth Day 1990 imagined environmentalism to be constituted by individual actors making voluntary choices that would protect the environment and soothe their anxiety. Rather than a sharp break from Reaganism, though, this period smoothed the transition to green neoliberalism, a new vision of environmental citizenship, in which the emotional life of capitalism is altered by the promise that the global environmental future can be secured by enlightened consumption. While environmental anxiety had often depended upon a notion of citizens in need of protection from the market, the therapeutic frame reimagines consumers as empowered players in the market. I would like to close by noting how this fusion of the personal and the planetary continues to shape depictions of global environmental problems today, and to delimit the vision of popular environmentalism. Consider the example of global warming. And in my book, I close with Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. Now, the American failure to address the impending climate crisis in a more responsible way has been explained by a number of factors, including the right-wing corporate-sponsored effort to foster scientific uncertainty by denying the consensus on the causes of anthropogenic climate change. In addition to this, though, I think we need to consider how the popular framing of environmentalism as a market-oriented, green consumerist strategy also contributed to the national neglect of climate change. Indeed, the limits to environmental reform were embedded within these depictions of the movement as a personal consumer response to crisis. While the repeated emphasis on individual responsibility furthered a popular commitment to recycling, while pesticide fears boosted sales of organic food and led high-end grocers to expand their market share, the neoliberal template did not call upon the state to limit greenhouse gas emissions or curb the power of globalizing corporations. Americans instead were urged to recycle, and if they could afford to, shop their way to ecological salvation. In a period marked by periods of rising rates of economic inequality, green consumerism catered to the affluent and obscured questions of power relations. The structural systemic assault on the ecosphere continued. The release of greenhouse gases and the production of toxicity escalated, and the poor and racial minorities, both within the United States and in the global South, experienced higher rates of ecological risk. All of this happened while recycling programs expanded across the US, while green consumer products promised to shield the affluent from harm, and while recycling and other individual actions provided Americans with a therapeutic dose of environmental hope. Thanks very much for your attention.